Hi, folks, it's Ray. Happy New Year from Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast. And have we got a little treat for you? It's been taking me some time to get this guy onto the cast. And when we did eventually manage to get the recording done, and then Ray managed to work his way through the editing of said recording, we have created two little gems for you. Sometimes in life, we're fortunate enough to meet people who are both interesting and inspiring, and I've got one such person for you. Patrick Tomlinson is an absolute legend in my book. He's the sort of person, we all know some of them, you could literally talk to them for hours. So we did. We opened the microphones and we talked. Now, we did start off with a plan. We always start off with a plan, but as also is the way on Leaders and Managers Hub, we very quickly threw said plan out the window. Because when you're having an engaging conversation, you can't confine it against a series of set questions or a particular pathway that you want to go. When you meet inspiring and interesting people, you've just got to let the conversation flow. And then the beauty of it is that you can set it up more naturally during the edit. And that's exactly what we've done. So we sat down with Patrick, we opened the microphones and we talked. And the output of that is, as I said, two beautiful little gems. Part one, we talk about Patrick's experience. Patrick has worked in critical care for young people who have been heavily traumatized. And he started that career in an era where we would imagine that these subjects were more taboo than they are now. But I'm sure you'll find as you listen to part one that actually it was perhaps a more enlightened era than we currently live in. And I think we have some significant lessons to learn from it. We talk a little bit about how trauma can affect children and adults, of course, because children grow into adults, and how interventions of an appropriate nature can have dramatic positive effects, and how we can turn what are seemingly odds that are stacked against us into significantly positive outcomes. So I hope you're going to enjoy part one. Part two, we talk a little bit more about the here and now practical application of Patrick's experience in leadership and management, how his assessment tool is helping to identify and promote people at all levels of the organization, be it entry level or be it executive level. There's a lot to be learned from the assessment tool he's got. But that's in part two, all in good time. For now, here's part one. We hope you enjoy. It's just so incredible. Gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Now have you ever wondered how the best did it? They never second guessed, they didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission, listen, it's beyond description. We don't wanna fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of passion that you can't imagine. Don't hesitate, rub the lamp a lad. So today on Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast, we have Patrick Tomlinson from Patrick Tomlinson Associates. Good evening, Patrick.
Evening, Ray.
Patrick is based in the United States of America, so we're very appreciative that he's been able to join us this evening. So let's just get straight into the meat and two veg of it. Patrick, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your professional background.
Thank you, Ray, and thank you very much for inviting me to your podcast. Yeah, I've been working for 35 years now. I started off work in a therapeutic community for children and young people in Cirencester, England. That's where the community was based. And the young people were what used to be called before then juvenile delinquents, but actually young people who had suffered such severe adversity in their early childhoods that their development was seriously delayed and disrupted. I've been involved in that kind of work for, you know, on and off throughout my career. But as time went on, I got into management leadership positions. And for the last 10 years, I've been working independently, helping organizations develop their models and providing consultancy, mentoring, supervision, and also doing some work in the assessment of adults for professional roles. So I'm creating an assessment process that looks at their suitability for different positions and also at their developmental needs.
And so, Patrick, just tell us, the community that you started out in, what was that called?
It was called the Cotswold Community. It was in the Cotswolds, surprisingly.
Yeah.
Set up by the English or British government in 1967 as an alternative to the approved school system that had been in existence following, I think, in the post-war years. Approved school, similar to Borstal, quite a, you know, harsh regime where young people that had got into trouble were placed, but was highly ineffective at helping these young people make much progress. In fact, statistics suggest that up to 85% of the young people that were in such places would end up in prison. So the government in the 1960s, I think, became very interested in the possibility of creating a different approach to helping these young people and set up two therapeutic communities. One was the Cotswold Community, the other was called Pepper Harrow. And the regime of these places, or you could say the approach, was absolutely different in virtually every respect to the previous regime. So the change process was, you know, very difficult and challenging.
It was quite quite forward thinking for its time, I would suggest.
Yes, thank you, Ray. It was the 1960s. Yeah, it was an interesting time, and I think the therapeutic community movement, which the Cotswold Community was part of, had been influenced significantly by the fields of psychiatry and psychoanalysis. And interestingly, the Tavistock Institute that provided, Institute of Human Relations, that provided consultancy to the Cotswold Community from when it began in the late 1960s all the way through to I think into the 1990s, started during the war years, providing consultation to the military during the war, World War II. Some of the significant people involved at the Tavistock at the beginning were Wilfred Bion, Elliot Jakes, John Bowlby, Isabel Menzies-Lyth, and Kurt Lewin, who was significant influence on organisational psychology, also had an influence on the Tavistock Institute. And in fact, one of the first therapeutic communities, or sometimes regarded as the first therapeutic community, was set up following the end of World War II to provide rehabilitation to soldiers that were traumatised you know, through their experiences in the war. And one of the first consultants that we had at the community, Isabel Menzies-Lyth, was also renowned for some seminal work she did in relation to hospitals as organisations. And it's interesting to think of, you know, the war situation, the military role, the therapeutic communities such as the Cotswold Community and hospitals. These were all, you could say, organisations carrying out extreme work in the sense that there were very serious issues involved, matters of life and death, literally in a physical sense, but also in a psychological sense. So these types of organisation were very good places to carry out research. And the Tavistock Institute's way of working was very much a form of action research, where the consultancy process also became part of a research process. And these types of organisation were very fertile grounds for organizational research because of their extreme nature. All of the ordinary things in organizations, such as leadership, management, clarity of task, boundaries, all very much tested in this in these types of environment.
Yeah, I mean, it's for people of my generation, we need to remind ourselves that it was only some 20 years after the end of the Second World War, and a whole generation had been traumatized and psychologically affected by that whole event. So the world was trying to come to terms with the fallout from that.
Yes, and I think quite a lot of really positive innovations happened at that time as a consequence of just what you're saying. In the Cotswold community, I should mention, I didn't actually start there in 1967. By the time I arrived, it was 1985, and therefore had been running for 18 years, and by this time was very well established and had gathered an international reputation. We used to have students and other visitors coming from all over the world on placements or short visits. And
can I just ask, Patrick, was it also like a research facility?
Yeah, it was, in fact. And the way that we were encouraged to work, I think, was to think of ourselves as people that were helping something grow and develop. So we weren't officially called researchers or anything like that. But the culture was very much one where the emphasis was on learning from experience. So even though the way of working was well established when I arrived, it was almost without it being made explicit. The message, I think, to you was that there's room for everyone here to reflect upon their experience, make connections, new insights, and contribute to the ongoing process of development. Mm-hmm. And I think the input from the Tavistock Institute was influential in that sense, because they often, the consultants there that we used for a long period of time, often referred to the concept of action research, which means research based upon experience, learning from real experience, not just laboratory academic type of research. And the studies that we did on the outcomes for the young people that were at the Cotswold community, and they normally would stay for between 3 and 5 years. I think it was by the late 1980s, maybe early 1990s. It was found that instead of 85% of the young people ending up in prison, the whole outcome had been turned upside down. So now it was only 10 to 15% that would end up in prison, and 85% would go on to lead, you know, reasonably positive lives to varying degrees. So it was a reversal of the approved school system. Hmm. And then that led to quite a lot of other organizations, therapeutic communities, developing, I would say, from the 1970s into the 1980s.
I've just at this point just want to say, for me, like, it's quite striking that there was obviously an effort there to avoid young people falling into the criminal justice system, and for some reason, I don't know when it happened, but we seem to have let that whole thing go, and now all of these things have been dealt with as criminal justice issues and not health issues, and these things are starting to come back to bite us as a society, because we've got all sorts of, you know, homelessness and drug abuse issues that generally quite often start out as trauma somewhere along the line, and because we don't really invest in our young people to support them psychologically in their early years, we end up having to manage things as a, you know, manage the symptoms of that often as criminal justice issues.
Yeah, I think that's
a bit of a shame.
It is, and I think the potential to develop from that period that I'm referring to was lost a little bit. But then I think now, with all of the research that is coming out of neuroscience, many of the same principles that were the services were based upon, the thinking was based upon in the 1960s and 70s have been reaffirmed, such as attachment is vital for any young person to develop into a healthy adult. And many of the young people that we see that you're referring to that end up in the juvenile justice system, invariably, I would say, have serious attachment difficulties in their childhood and won't actually be likely to recover and get better without being in some kind of environment where those difficulties can be addressed, usually by providing an experience of a positive attachment. So I think there, you know, there is a sort of reconnection with research in the last 5 to 10 years and the huge impact, I think, of neuroscience, which I think has potential, if governments and societies take notice of it, to really make a big difference and pick up on some of the same progress and thinking that was made in previous generations.
Like, I'm just sitting here listening to you thinking that, you know, we talk an awful lot about child health, physical health and obesity and them needing to have physical exercise and all that sort of thing. And yet we absolutely don't ever talk about there need to be regular and routine psychological support. And, you know, we do acknowledge as a society that you've got to look after the brain as much as that as the body, but we don't seem to have got to that yet. Really?
It's interesting that you say that, Ray, because I think it probably is significantly influenced by sometimes which country you're living in, sometimes which circle of people you work with, live with, be friends with. Because I think there's very different degrees of awareness. In America, where I am now, there is quite a big emphasis emerging in schools about children's psychological well-being. I think there is growing awareness in the United Kingdom, but it's always challenged by the economics of the situation. So investment in promoting awareness of providing resources costs money. And as you well know, we've been going through periods of recession, austerity, and unfortunately a lot of the very services that would help in these areas in some countries have been severely cut back. But the irony with that is that it doesn't actually save money in the long term. Bruce Perry, one of the, I suppose, most well-known neuroscientists in the United States, has carried out research on this and has repeatedly said that for every $1 invested in early intervention, in other words, getting to young people and their families early on rather than later on when problems have developed and got more severe, he says for every $1 invested, you'll save $10 in the long term.
So. Yeah, and that conversation has really kicked off here in the UK, but regarding physical health. So they talk about, you know, if we manage to support children's physical health, then we won't end up with adults who have chronic and multiple illnesses later in life, thus putting stress on our National Health Service. And it's not a massive leap to make that same argument for mental health. And, you know, again, if we could reduce the number of people in the criminal justice system because we managed to get to them as children and work with them to unlearn the traumatic experiences that they've had, outcomes may be better for all of us. And I think part of the issue is the short-termism of political cycles. And so there being a political will to invest in these things in the short term, And also, I think that businesses and societies need to step up a little bit, Patrick, here, because the ideal business has people in it who are well-rounded individuals. And we need to, therefore, invest in them, in those children as early as they get into education, whether it's nursery school or primary school, because they're the future chief executives of our organizations. And if we can bring out well-rounded, well-balanced, capable, resilient young people, we will be much better set for what is going to be absolutely an uncertain future faced with significant challenges in the world. And I think the UK has a particular issue, because although we've started to have the conversation around mental health, there's still a massive stigma attached to it. And my US friends just don't seem to have. And I think we've got a lot to learn here, to be honest.
Yeah. And I think some of the need is really at is early intervention, early prevention. Therefore, mental health, but mental health before it becomes a mental health problem.
Everybody has mental health as in the same way as everybody has physical health, and you take a child to the GP and they get regularly checked out and stuff, and we have health visitors and all sorts of things, but we just don't seem to make the leap into that mental health is exactly the same thing.
Yes, and one thing I was reading yesterday was making the clear point that we have a vast amount of information, research, but for some reason at the moment, a lot of it is being ignored. For example, there's a study that people in my field of work will know well called the ACEs study. It means Adverse Childhood Experiences. And what it shows is you can identify an adverse experience as something like parental divorce during childhood, or a parent with drug addiction, or a parent with serious, significant mental health problem, such as depression, or death in the family. These are all things which on their own can be, a lot of them can be moved on from. But if it's multiple, so if a child is brought up in an environment where there isn't just one adverse experience or two, but say six or seven, that is usually an environment that has become chronically dysfunctional. The impact is increasingly negative. So the ACE study came about by an insurance company in the USA that had 17,000 people on its records over a long period of time, 20, 30 years, I can't remember precisely. And it looked at the health outcomes of these people who were just not collected for any other purpose than ordinary people needing health insurance. So it was just a typical range of people. And what was found was that the people with five or six, what was called ACE, Adverse Childhood Experiences, had significant, very significant risks of having many physical illnesses as well as other problems, such as even risk of diabetes, cancer, heart problem. For people with over six, their life expectancy was significantly reduced. So when we talk about the body and mind, I think we also need to think that they are actually separate, that the many physical problems are caused by mind-related problems, and vice versa. The body has an impact on the mind. They're not, it's a connected system, not two different systems as if they are independent of each other. So many of the physical problems that you've mentioned could also have their roots in psychologically related problems, difficulties in attachment, neglect, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things that I learned in this therapeutic community, which was pioneering in its time. Right from day one, I learned that people can recover from whatever adversity they've experienced. So no matter what the child's experience had been and the amount of difficulty that had caused for the child, sometimes the young people would have had numerous placement breakdowns, having been removed from their own families. They would have been excluded from school, you know, endless amount of difficulty, unable to manage their feelings. So these young people that could be 10 years old or 12 years old would have panic attacks on a daily basis, and very serious panic attacks where they would attack the people trying to help them, and they would need to be physically held to ensure their safety. So the difficulty was extreme, but it was also clear to me from the way the whole place run that recovery was possible. So that these days we would say that the brain is plastic, the plasticity of the brain. So the brain can be damaged and its development can be seriously delayed and distorted, but it's also capable of recovery, but only given the right kind of environment. In fact, the kind of trauma that I'm talking about is often referred to now as developmental trauma because of the impact it has on a young person's development. One of the young people I'm thinking of now that I was the carer for, so he was one of the first young people that I had responsibility for. And I remember him saying to me that when, not long after he arrived, that he would drain the life out of me. And he seemed convinced about this, so it did make me feel a bit anxious. I reread his file, and I found out that the three foster mothers that had looked after him previously had indeed all had a nervous breakdown. So in his mind, he was actually being quite serious, and he thought he had the power to literally drain the life out of people. And I guess that's probably what people had said to him. I could imagine a foster carer, you know, at the end of the tether, saying something like, "You're draining the life out of me." But in all of these cases, the unfortunate thing that happened was that the people who were trying to care for him did actually have some kind of breakdown. And as a consequence, this boy was then moved on. And by the time he got to me being his carer, he'd probably moved on 5 or 6 times. And what I'm trying to get across by this little story is that, you know, the work is extremely difficult. And looking after children might not sound like a demanding, extreme kind of occupation, but I think you could actually say it is one of the roles that, you know, is so challenging that you've got to be a very resilient person to do it, and you've also got to be in an environment that is strong, where the support network is strong. And that is the reason, I suppose, that breakdown happens so often, and why many of the organisations that provide the services have such severe difficulties with the work. In fact, many organisations can become themselves traumatised, and the organisation starts working in a dysfunctional manner that can feel quite similar to the backgrounds and histories of the young people, tendencies towards reactiveness, punitiveness, chaos, muddled boundaries, lack of clarity. So many of these organisations over the years have survived for a period of time and then come to an end for one reason or another. It's quite unusual, in fact, to find many organisations that provide this service that last more than 20 to 30 years, although there are some excellent examples of ones that have done, and longer. But it is a very challenging area of work and very challenging for leaders involved in running these organisations to keep the organisations on task and ensure that services provided safely and young people are achieving positive outcomes.
Can I just say at this point as well, Patrick, so that's causing me in my head to ask the question, is it valued enough? Similarly to teaching, because if you're somebody who's looking after the well-being of young people, whether you're a teacher or a carer or whatever it might be, you have a huge responsibility and a huge influence on shaping that young person's life and therefore potentially shaping how they interact in the future and how society benefits from them being very effective as people. And I wonder sometimes if we haven't deprofessionalized certainly teaching a little bit, and also then with mental health care and social care in general, whether it's kind of been a bit of a race to the bottom because it's been driven by economics rather than we know the cost of everything and the value of nothing. Do you think that that's had an influence on it, Patrick?
Well, definitely. The young people who need intervention, positive, helpful service, you know, such as foster care or therapeutic residential care, they've got such challenges because of their histories. The outcomes can go in two directions. Recovery can happen, and it's possible then for the young person to pick up on a fairly typical life trajectory. They can go to university, get qualifications. They might not go to university, but get an apprenticeship or whatever. But they would have the same options and possibilities that are open to most young people. So the outcome can be extremely positive. And I certainly know now some young people that I've worked with who are 40 years old, who are very successful and effective, who do important jobs, enjoy their lives, have their own families, look after their children well, healthy individuals. And on the other hand, I know some young people from the earlier periods of my work who have committed very serious crimes and in prison and would have a lifetime of being in prison. So the difference between someone who is going to be a burden on society, either because they just can't work or because more seriously than that, they actually directly impact upon people's well-being, committing crimes and being institutionalized in prisons, hospitals, compared with a young person who is not only able to enjoy a good life, but contributing to society, economically making a contribution. So there is this split off, really, where the consequence that a problem is not fully taken on board. And therefore, I think you're right. It is, the problem is, or the need is devalued. And I think part of the reason for that is to do with the short-termism that you've mentioned. But I also think it is because the issue is still a taboo issue. And there is a resistance, and it might be partly unconscious in societies, to actually be fully aware of and take some ownership for the suffering of children, which usually happens in a family context. And I think it's something which we still don't really want to talk about and think about. It's like one of those problems that historically has been pushed out of view, such as the so-called lunatic asylums that would be hidden away from society. No, I don't think we're quite still in that place, but I still think the lack of valuing is because it's a problem we'd rather not think about.
Yes, and society, certainly in this part of the world, is very good at shutting out, blocking out the things that we really don't want to acknowledge. I mean, you'd be aware, we'll get on a little bit later to your the work you've done in Ireland, but obviously you're familiar with Ireland, as am I. And we've very recently, in the last couple of years, had the scandal of the Magdalen laundries and the mother and baby homes and all that sort of thing, and which was happening, you know, in front of everybody's eyes. Everybody knew about it, but nobody really wanted to deal with it. So we're very good at that. I just want to take this opportunity, sorry, Patrick, just to say for our listeners, so Patrick's got a French bulldog next to him right now. Beautiful, beautiful animal. So you might hear him snoring from time to time. So hopefully it's him snoring and not our listeners nodding off, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. Yes, my dog always likes to sit next to me when I'm talking to people.
He obviously finds you very soothing, Patrick.
Yeah, no, he's quite nice to have there. And but I can't, with ear plugs in, quite often I can't actually hear him snoring myself.
Oh, well, I can hear him, no problem. All the way from the US to the UK.
Thanks, Roy. It's his moment of fame.
That's right.
Anyway, so... so we were talking there about problems being pushed aside and not really looked at. And I think the reality of children having such difficulties in the family context is one of those problems, and because it challenges the notion of family life. It's the side of family life we'd rather not have to think about. So I think... And you find this, in fact, when if you try to put a children's home, a new home for children that have had to be taken into care, if you put one in a neighbourhood that hasn't previously had one, quite often a lot of the neighbours are in panic. And they become very worried about this.
And quite yes, often, and there can be some significant opposition to these things.
Huge opposition. Mm. And I remember once a neighbour where we were putting a new home kept asking me about these children, and his main concern was had they been abused. So the subject of sexual abuse is also part of this fear and anxiety, that not only had the children suffered in the family context, but quite often they've also been abused. And the abuse might be emotional, it might be physical, might also be sexual abuse. So the concept of sexual abuse in families is very disturbing for people. Anyway, so this neighbour, this was the one thing he just couldn't seem to get off his mind. So he'd ask me in his house and give me a cup of tea, and he'd keep coming back to this all the time, but have the children been abused? And why are they here? The other fear is that if the child has been abused, they will abuse other children, which then feeds into the stranger danger concept that children are at risk of being abused by people on the street. Whereas the reality is that the majority of abuse takes place in the family, and the odds on any child that a young person had in the home actually abusing a stranger is very, very remote. In fact, I can hardly think of one instance over the whole of my career. But that was his fear and anxiety, and I would try to just explain these young people need to be in a home because of not having the kind of childhood we would like any child to have. We would like all children to be brought up in a way that is positive and healthy, but unfortunately these children have not had that for whatever reason, and therefore they need a special kind of place to be to give them some of the experience they've missed. And in fact, the only thing that got him off the subject, and I might have been a bit defensive on my point, I said, well, if the statistics are accurate, it may be that 1 in 10 people in this street have been abused. And that...
That gave him pause for thought.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he really didn't say anything after that. But,
yeah.
I'm not sure if it was a helpful comment on my part.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, you know, like to bring this back to the context of Leaders and Managers Hub. So on one hand, you may have people within your organization who you have line management or leadership responsibility for, who are either suffering from these sorts of traumas, or have a member of their family who is suffering from these sorts of traumas. So we absolutely need to talk about it. And we need to get it out there, and it needs to not be taboo. We need to drag it out into the light, because it's the only way we'll effectively deal with it.
That is very true. And it's the only way that the trauma will take its place in the past of the person, rather than continuously living in the present. So trauma that is not talked about and resolved, but I don't suppose resolve is the right word, but integrated into the person's life history, so the person can say, whether it's to themselves or to someone else, when I was such and such an age, this is what happened to me, I know what it felt like, I know what the consequences was. That, you know, is an integrated experience, whereas the trauma that is not integrated into the person's narrative of their own life and history, it becomes, a man called Bessel van der Kolk explains this very well, it becomes stuck in the body. It's like embodied. It's an embodied experience and not an experience that can be thought about.
Yes.
And therefore, people are still prone to have continuous feelings such as anxiety, sudden feelings, you know, of the heart beating faster, palpitations, you know, those kind of feelings of dread that we might experience from time to time when you know something horrible is about to happen, nightmares, flashbacks, all that sort of thing.
Yes. Or if you're a student of Eric Byrne and transactional analysis, you mm-hmm. might understand that sometimes the child, the person can effectively cut off their whole child's ego state, because the pain and the trauma from it is just too much to bear. And that's where all our energy and our zest for life and our vigor comes from, and how that will present in later life is that people can be chronically depressed because they have completely cut off that part of themselves. So if you're into your transactional analysis theories, you know, that's a manifestation of it right there.
Yeah, there's many different manifestations, and we are trying, I think, to be more open about these things and to give people the opportunity to begin the process of talking about something. So like you've said, Ray, every organisation should at least have some process within it where the individual can acknowledge something in a confidential manner and receive or have access to a professional who might be able to guide them in the right direction. In fact, I watched yesterday a very interesting video about Barber, who had started a process within the barber profession, haircutting, because he said that he realised that for a lot of people, when they go to have their haircut, they talk more to their barber than they might talk to many people in their lives. He said he gave one example where someone showed him a picture of his girlfriend when he started going out with her, then a picture of when they got married, and then when a baby scan took place, and all that sort of thing. People can share intimate things with someone like a barber, as an example. Mm-hmm. And he said at times people shared intimate things that were concerning, such as feeling very depressed, and he felt he didn't really know how to respond to start with. So he started a movement. This was on a TED talk. He started a movement where barbers could connect and learn something about the value of being able to listen, but also how to respond in a way that might be helpful.
Yes, or even just to be aware of places where you can signpost people.
Yes,
to.
Absolutely. So he was making the point that I'm not suggesting that the barber becomes a counsellor or a therapist, but it could help in some way just to know what is helpful to say and what isn't, and as you say, where to signpost people to. And he gave a couple of examples where people that were his clients for haircuts had said to him that without what he had said, they might have killed themselves. Like one person said that they were actually thinking of it and drove the car to somewhere where they were going to do it, and but didn't because of the conversation they had had, and it made him, this person said, turn around and do something different. Anyway, so it was a powerful example of how in any industry, awareness in the area that we're talking about can be very helpful.
And in a similar vein, Patrick, I've been lucky enough to, I've done some volunteering with a local charity here in Kent, and one of the training modules that I was required to attend was on safeguarding. And I would encourage all organizations to make safeguarding training a mandatory module for all of their employees, because whether you work in an environment where you're interacting with people who may be vulnerable, be they young people or vulnerable adults or whatever, in wider society, to have had the training so that you can maybe identify some of the early signs where something is not quite right and know where to go with that is vital as a community. Because I think we need to go back to, you know, the pre-industrial age where communities actually looked out for each other a little bit better. And, you know, people would go to the barber in this case or whatever and you know, maybe share some information, and the barber would know where to signpost them to. Similarly, I think, you know, I've was given some good examples during the safeguarding training where particularly young children were actually saved by the vigilance of a taxi driver in one example. Because that taxi driver just had an instinct. And I think we could do more. It's an uncomfortable subject topic, and it's an uncomfortable course to sit, but it is vital, I think.
Yeah, it's very important. And I think you made an important connection that, you know, mentioning the industrial era. So I guess you're talking about 100, 150 years ago. That kind of time. And we know that communities were, well, there was many problems at that time, so we don't want to paint too much of a rose-tinted view of it. But nevertheless, people grew up in better connected communities. I mentioned Bruce Perry earlier, and his research has said that if you went back 100 years or so in America, the average child would have contact every day with at least 8 to 10 significant adults. Whereas the adults that the child knows well, you know, so it could be parents, family, extended family, close friends. He said now the average number of adults that the child has contact with is less than 2 a day.
That is remarkable.
Yeah.
And that is truly remarkable.
Yeah. So not, that also reflects the high prevalence of single parent families.
Yes, and that's not to sort of denigrate single parent families. I mean, you know, they absolutely do an amazing job. But again, being Irish, we often in Ireland talk about the days where, you know, families lived together in large family groups and looked out for each other, and that sense of community. Yep. And I think our urban living nowadays almost prevents that. I mean, anecdotally, you'll hear about how people will live in a building for 10 years and not even know the name of their next door neighbor. Yes. And we talk about it a lot more in terms of looking out for our elderly and more vulnerable senior citizens. But we don't seem to, again, we seem to concentrate on these little sectors. We don't look at the bigger picture in terms of, like, you know, you might have a vulnerable elderly person to your right and a vulnerable young person to your left. And yes. You just don't know from any one day to the next.
No, and as you've said, right, the single parent is not in any way being, there's no judgment on that issue at all. But for the single parent, one of their challenges is, as well as bringing up children on their own, is being in an environment where quite often they are isolated.
That, yes.
Even two parents bringing up a child might still be isolated from extended family. If you're one person bringing up a child and you haven't got many others around you for support, the difficulty of that is absolutely huge. So we bring even, I suppose it's quite typical that people might be living away from their families and might, you know, it's quite common that people don't have a close extended support network around them, which has made life more challenging from an individual point of view. It's made bringing up children more challenging. And in fact, if you went back to the time you were referring to, the children would have spent time with a lot of different people.
Yes.
They would not have been so dependent just upon the nuclear family.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been daily contact with uncles, aunties, grandparents, etc. So we live in a period that has become quite isolated, I think, for many people.
Yes. And I think technology is starting to isolate children even more, Patrick. Because they're, you know, where I was a child and I couldn't wait to get home from school to go out and play football with, like, neighbors and siblings and stuff. Unfortunately now, an awful lot of young people, partly because of a safety issue, aren't encouraged to be outside in the evenings and stuff. And so there's a sense of isolation there too.
Yeah, and we don't really understand fully the pros and cons of modern technology, and on the one hand connecting people in some ways that is positive, but at the same time the risks and issues that you're referring to. And I remember when you mentioned Ireland, I remember when I was in Ireland walking past a school and I saw five or six young people all standing leaning up against a wall together, but they weren't really together. Every one of them was looking at their mobile phone talking to someone else.
Yeah.
Looking at something else.
So that was part one. Told you it'd be interesting and thought-provoking. Anyway, you've got time now to go and put the kettle on, make yourself a cup of tea, get yourself some biscuits as well. Come on, it's New Year, treat yourself. The diet can start next week. Settle yourself down with your cup of tea and your biscuits and go and listen to part two. Gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Now have you ever wondered how the best did it? They never second guessed, they didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission, listen, it's beyond description. We don't wanna fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of passion.